Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
The last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
At least it looks good from space. A catalogue of modern, millennial and personal catastrophes. Carl Kinsella, you're very welcome on The Last Word.
Thank you for having me, Matt. I'm delighted to be here.
Is this a sort of a millennial memoir in the form of essays?
Honestly, I think that's probably a very good description, because I've been struggling to sort of articulate my own elevator pitch for this book. And I think that kind of hits the nail on the head. That is exactly what it is. You know, it's not exclusively, I suppose, through a generational millennial sort of lens, but it definitely is. It's from I was born in 1993. So these essays are all kind of events and observations and funny things that have happened to me throughout my life. And obviously, the perspective that I have is very much informed by when I was born and the sort of, you know, the culture in which I was raised. And so it is probably quite a millennial book. I think probably millennials will read it and I would say recognize a lot of themselves in the stories I'm telling.
Also very much informed, and this is probably a more serious and not as otherwise a humorous book, by OCD.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about what it is like to live with OCD. And also to be aware that people might have a perception of it, which actually has little to do with the reality.
Yeah, so OCD is, an initialism for obsessive compulsive disorder. And I suppose one of the things I always try to get across to people is that, you know, all of us have obsessions and all of us have compulsions. You know, that's something that exists in every human brain. And I think the thing that people need to understand about it is the disorder part of it. Because it's when those obsessions and compulsions become so powerful in your mind that they start to sort of overrule the rational side of your brain. And it makes it very, very difficult to go about your life in any kind of fulfilling way, because you are being sort of beset on all sides by fears and worries and doubts that really ultimately can cause you to lose your grip on reality. I think the thing with obsessive compulsive disorder is that it's intrusive thoughts. That is really the kind of primary symptom. And what intrusive thoughts are, they're thoughts you don't want. You know, it is what it sounds like. You can't control it, but it puts a huge strain, I think, on the mind and on the body to try to fight back against these thoughts that come sort of very unbidden. You know, you don't want them. You don't want them in your brain. All they really do is cloud your judgment and mess with the way that you go about your life. So in terms of living with it, it is challenging. And like, for example, like I don't really have a problem admitting that, like, I'm quite resentful of it. You know, like sometimes you hear people talk about certain illnesses, and I think particularly sort of neurodivergent type of illnesses, and people can find, I think, a lot of peace with them, and they can find sort of that those ways of thinking can inform their creativity or inform the way they go about the world in a way that they can kind of get almost some sort of, they can kind of work with it. Whereas I do find OCD to be purely an obstacle.
You're like not accepting of it.
No, I don't like it. Yeah, like there's never a moment where I'm like, oh, well, you know, at least it gives me this or at least it gives me that. Like, I do just find it an inherently harmful thing.
Even though it is what it is.
What do you mean?
Is that you can't change it?
Yeah,
can you?
Yeah. Sort of like, you can't change. And to be fair, I mean, like, it's almost certainly a failing of mine that I'm simply not Buddhist enough to sort of, you know, this kind of accepting the things you cannot change sort of thing. I think I still am sort of raging against the dying of the light to some degree. It's not that I don't accept it, because of course I accept that it's part of my life and there's nothing I can do to remove it. So there has to be some degree of playing ball with it. But, you know, certainly as I sort of articulate in the book, it is sort of, when it's bad, it can really be a litany of really quite disturbing thoughts that do just make it, you know, it puts huge constraints on your quality of life, you know.
Can you give me concrete examples?
I'll give you, yeah, a few concrete examples. But one that I have mentioned a few times is, there's one time my dad was giving me a driving lesson. And this was kind of during a period where I was particularly sort of susceptible to these intrusive thoughts. And I crashed it into like a council car park railing. And there was nobody around. It was early in the morning, totally, you know, nobody within, God knows, a kilometre of us, whatever.
And nothing hurt except your ego.
Yes, nobody was hurt, nothing like that. But I believed, truly believed, that I had hit a child. You know, like I could convince myself of that. And so like I went home. You know, I stopped there. I looked at the car. There was no blood anywhere. There was no body to be found. But I went home and I said to my mom, look, Dad has to go back over there and take photos of that because I just can't accept. I can't accept that this delusion that I'm suffering isn't real. And that is honestly like, I'm not joking here. That's a mild example. Like the level of sort of paranoia and delusional thinking that falls upon people who have OCD is really severe and it very off the wall.
What would your parents say in a situation like this to try and reassure you?
Well, my mom is brilliant. I think my mom deserves huge credit because I think it's not an easy thing to understand by any stretch, particularly like, you know, she would have been raised in the 60s without too much, or I would imagine, any sort of grounding in mental health and the way we think about it now. So the way that she is able, she's so good because whenever I come to her with these fears, she never ever, she doesn't meet them halfway at all. You know, she's not like, oh, well, yes, maybe that's true to some extent. Like she will just tell me straight up, like, no, there's no chance that that's the case. Because the things I worry about are consistently off the wall. They are things like what I've just described. They're not realistic worries, you know?
Have you had help for that?
Yes, I have. Like, so over the years, I've done a lot of therapy. I'm relatively heavily medicated, I would say. But yeah, I've had lots of help, you know, whether it's therapy, different kinds of that. I've done psychoanalysis, I've done CBT. And also I do have a really great support network of friends and family. And I think that is a massive thing as well.
Given the love you're clearly showing for your mother there, is that why you're so against the Irish mammy jokes and the cliche of them, knowing that the mother in Ireland, in many cases, is a far more rounded, deeper individual than that cliche?
Yeah, absolutely. Like 100%. This idea of like the Irish mammy who is obsessed with the immersion and, you know, getting the wooden spoon and the drying and stuff, it's just so far removed from my own mother. And like, I find like my mother a really interesting person. Like she was raised in like a council house in Crumlin. Like there was not money to go to university, anything like that. Like my mom is such an intelligent woman. Like she was capable, she would have been capable of doing, she could have been a barrister, solicitor, anything. And so I think for me, when I think about the stereotype of an Irish mammy, and it's just so, and I know my mom would hate those jokes as well. She just doesn't, because she doesn't see herself in them. You know, she doesn't see that as a reflection, even in that caricaturistic way. She just doesn't see it as an accurate portrayal, I think, certainly of how she sees herself and probably how she sees a lot of other women in her life. So yeah, I think that's why I don't like it. And I definitely stand by that. I find it kind of grating, kind of cheap, just not very funny, you know?
You also have a chapter in the book about your use of the internet, which I find very interesting as well, because I would have become aware of you as sort of a wisecracking guy on Twitter.
I didn't know you were aware of me, but that's
absolutely
great.
Aware of you and stuff, and I've been following your stuff for a long time on that. Although I think you post a lot less now, don't you?
Yeah, I actually don't even, like I actually deleted my Twitter a few weeks ago. Like I'd stopped using it around last Christmas. And now I've kind of taken the final plunge and just gotten rid of it because I just no longer find it useful. It's just such a kind of a broken platform, just in terms of the user base, but also in terms of the actual, digital infrastructure of it. Like it's kind of falling apart. So it's just not a pleasant place to be, I find.
But I think more importantly than that, I think, and I'm probably summarizing this, so excuse me if I've got it wrong, but I think you're right about how the bedroom used to be the safest place you could be, your sort of cocoon, and now it's become, because of the smartphone in your hand, an exceptionally dangerous place. Is that...
Yeah.
Have I got it right?
No, I think that's a very fair characterization, yeah. Because the way I think about it is now, like, you can... There's so... The visibility that comes with having a smartphone in your pocket, you know, with a high-definition camera that you can connect to anyone in the world, there are mistakes you can make. There are all sorts of vulnerabilities that come with that. And it's sort of like, as long as you have your phone and as long as you have access to these platforms and as long as there's the risk of you posting to these platforms, and I suppose I maybe see it this way because I'm maybe more paranoid than most people, but I do think that there's so much more risk involved. You know, it's much harder to unplug. I think all of us feel like we don't even have the right to unplug. You know, I think we all feel, you know, particularly those of us who work in news and work in media, we feel like, I think we need to be across everything all of the time. And I think when you have that kind of relationship with your phone and that kind of relationship with the internet, where you're constantly putting stuff out there, you do start to, like we are, I think, losing the safety that we once had, where you could shut your front door and you think, well, now I'm home. Nobody can touch me in here. It's really not like that anymore. You know, you can tweet something, you can put something out there and people can hate it and you can put yourself at risk. And, you know, I do think that that's, and I don't, and I just to be clear, I don't mean in a cancel culture kind of way. I do just mean in terms of you are posting things to a potentially huge audience. Not everybody's going to like what you say. A lot of people are going to react into, like, I mean, when you're talking about a huge audience, just statistically, a lot of those people could be angry. They could be, I mean, they could be unstable, all sorts of things. So once you are sort of trying to use that visibility to your benefit, you're also running the risk of that visibility like biting you in the ass quite bad.
You know, a lot of these tech companies put themselves up as free speech advocates and they shouldn't be in any way be moderated. But is that like sort of the 21st century version of literally putting free packets of cigarettes in people's hands on a daily basis? It's sort of a crack cocaine via the internet.
It really is. And it's, what's worse is that it's so disingenuous. Like, you know, if you look at Twitter and you see the kind of, like, Elon Musk does have restrictions on what you can say, you know, and typically it'll be something that if, you know, doesn't align with his politics, you know, he won't be happy with that. So this whole idea that these tech guys are free speech absolutists, you know, it's quite a transparent lie, I think, because you can see that when, you know, he doesn't like, for example, the use of the word cis, which I mean is quite an accepted term, I think, at this point, you know, like it just refers to someone who, you know, feels that they are the gender that they were assigned at birth. It's a very commonplace word now. So I think this idea that he's a free speech absolutist or that any of them are, is just such a, it's a lie really on their part.
Explain the title of the book, At Least It Looks Good From Space.
Yeah, I did sort of agonise. There was a lot of other titles that I ran through in my mind. The logic of At Least It Looks Good From Space is just meant to be a bit of a, like, almost like a sarky kind of comment that, like, if something is going very badly wrong in your own personal life, well, I think it's kind of nice to think that if you were to zoom out by like 18,000 kilometers and take a photo from like some space shuttle, it would look like a beautiful green and blue marble, you know, like, so.
Like the way Chris Hadfield found it.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's sort of like, it's, for me, it's like a philosophy of, like, it's a bit like Hakuna Matata for people who have like already given up a little bit, you know.
And you're at what age now?
I'm 32.
Okay. Do you feel cheated as a 32-year-old by the way Ireland has developed this century?
Yeah, I suppose cheated is a strong word because, and like, I mean, we think about this century as well, because I do think lots of generations have been failed in Ireland. Like, I don't necessarily think that my generation has been uniquely failed, you know, because obviously you think about this, the problems that people had in the past vis-a-vis like mother and baby homes, etc. Like, you know,
grinding poverty,
you know, living in tenement buildings. Like, there's so, like, Ireland does have a very rough history. And, like, you know, I can absolutely acknowledge the quality of life in so many ways now is better. I think what frustrates me so much about the sort of structure of society is that I think we could be doing way better. Like, I think lots of Irish people feel this way, that, like, it's not that Ireland is necessarily terrible, but it's just that there are mistakes we make that seem totally avoidable. I mean, like, and not to, like, kind of go off topic book-wise, but, like, and bang the drum, but, like, you think about the National Children's Hospital, the overspend. Like, I don't necessarily feel personally cheated by that, but I am hugely frustrated by it, because to me it's, you know, and I don't necessarily know anything about contract procurement and putting things out to tender, but I just don't accept that job is being done as well as it can be done. I mean, the same deal with the way we approach housing and, you know, kind of approach it in such a developer first kind of way, instead of taking some initiative to, you know, go a bit Sean Lamass on it and, like, you know, actually invest on a state level. You know, for me, I think that it confuses a lot of people as to why those choices aren't made. You think about the huge money, the windfall that came in from the Apple thing. You think about the sovereign fund that we have right now. There's huge money in that fund. And we're told that that's for a rainy day. And it's like, you know, for all these people who can't afford housing, and for the homeless people and people who can't access healthcare, I mean, it's plenty rainy, you know, like, it's lashing. So, you know, why are we so reluctant to take action? And so I don't know if I would necessarily use the word cheated, but, like, yeah, I absolutely do think that people are being failed. You know what I mean?
When are we going to see your first novel?
Oh, man. Hopefully soon. Like, I'm working on it. And, like, it really is just a matter, I suppose, of if someone wants to put it out. And, like, I desperately hope they do, because I love writing fiction. It's kind of definitely, in terms of my creative output, it's my first love. So I would be thrilled to.
That's a distraction from this, because people have to read the essays first.
Yeah.
At Least It Looks Good From Space, a catalogue of modern, millennial and personal catastrophes. Carl Kinsella, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Matt.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.